tonight on Arena. Winner of the Booker Prize David Soleil, Joe Philpott from Ruby Horse on his new memoir, and Declan Burke with the Crime Crackers of 2025. You're very welcome along, as always, to Tuesday Night's Arena. You can text us on 51551, our WhatsApp 0870 32. You can email arena at rte.ie, and we are on Instagram at rte_arena. Now, previously the winner of the Betty Trask Award, the Gordon Byrne Prize and the Plimpton Prize for Fiction, among others, David Soleil won the Booker Prize last month for his latest novel, Flesh, which was described by the judges as an astonishingly moving portrait of a man's life. The novel centres on István, who we first meet as a teenage boy. He's just moved with his mother to a small town near the Hungarian-Croatian border. I spoke to David Soleil earlier and began by asking him to tell us a little about who István is at the point we meet him.
Well, when we meet István, he's a sort of rather lonely 15-year-old living, as you say, in provincial Hungary with his mum, in a sort of just his mum. His dad is absent, and we don't really know why. He in the fourth first chapter of the book, he sort of gets drawn into a sexual relationship with a much older woman who lives in the building where he and his mum live, in a sort of housing estate. And that had unpredictable and ultimately sort of catastrophic consequences for him.
Yeah, I've read that you have said about what happens in that very, very first section of the book as being something you debated about including in the novel eventually, and whether or not you were going to do that. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the end of what happens at the end of that chapter, which is, I mean, somebody gets killed. I think we can say that. I did sort of both put that in and then take it out again and then put it back in and so on for quite a while, sort of dithered over that. And it was to do with, I guess, the sense that the death of this person might seem melodramatic or something, or just a bit too much, and it was important because it really had a big effect on what sort of book this turned out to be. And it obviously, in the end, I left this in, this incident, and it meant that the book turned out to be the kind of book in which these quite big dramatic events do happen. And the rest of the book is in fact quite, there are quite a few of these major, very dramatic events, often involving someone dying or something like that. And it was important for him, how the book turned out, I think.
He ends up leading quite a masculine life. He serves in the Hungarian army, and then he works as a bouncer later on. We meet him at various points throughout this. And then he works as a specialist security driver. Is Flesh a novel about male masculinity, or is it more specifically just about István's experience of his own masculinity?
I always slightly push back against the idea that Flesh is a novel primarily about masculinity. It is to some extent that, for sure, but I think it's not just that, and I wouldn't want it to be sort of too much categorized as that, because I think the book has considerably wider interests. And when I was writing it, that wasn't really my primary interest either, sort of questions of contemporary masculinity. But obviously, that is there too. It's a book about a male character in a very contemporary environment, so it's quite natural, I suppose, that some questions about masculinity in the contemporary world are there, for sure.
One of the interesting things about him as a character is that he's not especially articulate as a narrator, particularly when it comes to his own emotions. Is that a kind of a consequence of how the character emerged for you, or had you always planned to set yourself the kind of challenge of exploring the interior world of a semi-inarticulate character?
I wanted to have an inarticulate protagonist from the beginning, I think, because I didn't want a character who sort of explained themselves to the reader. I wanted a character who the reader would observe and come to their own views about as they observe this character over a very long period of time. The book takes place over many decades. So that was a decision that I made, a deliberate decision. The way the book begins, with the character as a sort of fairly isolated teenager did obviously sort of help to push it in that direction, or it established a way of writing about this person that emphasized their inarticulacy up to a point. Although again, I do think it would be possible to overemphasize quite how inarticulate Istvan is. He does actually sometimes say things, and indeed we get access to his thoughts and so on. So I think, sort of relative to a typical protagonist of a literary novel, he is perhaps quite inarticulate and opaque, but I wouldn't want to overdo that.
I'm interested to know about the initial inspiration for Flesh. Maybe talk to me a little bit about what was the spark that got this whole story started.
Yeah, there were a few different sort of ingredients in there at the beginning, I think. I mean, there was no one sort of spark as such. I wanted to write a book that had a Hungarian aspect and an English aspect, because my own life when I started writing it was very much sort of stretched between those two countries. I didn't feel entirely at home in either of them, and I wanted to kind of use that feeling somehow, or write about a character who was in a very different way from me, perhaps in a similar situation. I also wanted to write a book about life as a physical experience, and that was very important too. And obviously that contributed a lot towards the nature of Istvan's character, and to the sort of events that the story would be built around. That he would be a Hungarian who emigrated to England was something that I decided very early on. I thought that would be a very interesting story in terms of being a story about contemporary Europe as well, because I think one of the big phenomena in contemporary Europe is the way that there's been this enormous movement of people from the east to the west, essentially, for economic reasons in the last 20 years. And I was interested to write about that too.
Is it true that you started and abandoned it more than once?
Well, I abandoned another novel just before writing this. And that was a book that I've been working on for 2 or 3 years and was already sort of 80,000 words long or something. So that I abandoned a different book, and then it was quite difficult to then start another book because I was very uncertain. I felt I couldn't abandon another book. You know, to abandon one might be okay, but to abandon two would not be good for my confidence. So I was a bit nervous when I started writing this book that it should be on a strong footing and that it wouldn't be something that would have to be abandoned later. So I think in the very early stages of writing this book, I might have sort of written a bit and then set it aside and then come back to it and realized that actually it's pretty good and pushed on a bit more with it. And so it sort of wobbled into the air. But once it was airborne, I felt better about it than it was enjoyable to write.
I've seen you say, speaking about your previous work, that you enjoy books that are made of freestanding units. And in previous books, that might have meant short stories or linked short stories. How does that apply here to Flesh?
Yeah, I mean, the two books I wrote before Flesh, All That Man Is and Turbulence, All That Man is a collection of quite long stories, but nine of them that are sort of linked together in a non-narrative way, and Turbulence is kind of more of a collection of short stories in a way. All the Man Is, I think very much of as a novel, or certainly as a single unified book. So I was just in the habit of writing sort of self-contained short form pieces, and the chapters in Flesh, even though it's a more conventional novel in terms of its overall structure, the chapters in Flesh are kind of quite self-contained as well. And they often cover only a few weeks or months of Istvan's life. And then between the chapters, there are sort of years usually of undescribed time. And so it's like the chapters are like a series of glimpses that we get of him over 40 or 50 years.
Flesh, of course, won the Booker Prize earlier this month. Is it true you'd managed to persuade yourself that you wouldn't win?
Yeah, I actually did. I did a surprisingly good job of that. I All That Man Is had been shortlisted 9 years ago, and I'd had a really, really terrible experience on that occasion of the actual evening of the actual ceremony, because I'd been so nervous and stressed out and had felt, you know, been crushed by the sort of sense of what was at stake and all that kind of thing. So I this time I was very determined not to have just the same experience again. So I really did make an effort to persuade myself that I wasn't going to win. I should just enjoy the evening. And as I say, I was sort of surprisingly successful. People were amazed to see me actually eating the dinner and, you know, chatting to people and stuff. I did actually quite enjoy the whole thing. I was kind of weirdly, eerily calm. It was only when Roddy Doyle started to describe the winning book before naming it that I thought, actually, maybe this is me. I was kind of surprised.
Did you manage to get the deposit back on the dress suit that you'd rented?
Yeah, wow, that story has traveled. Yes, I that was a near miss. That could have really been terrible. No one told me that the dress code had changed from 9 years ago. So I did rent a sort of dinner suit, and I just found out the day before that I'd look like a complete idiot if I showed up wearing that. I didn't get the deposit back exactly, but they also sell things in the shop, and they let me buy stuff with the money that I would have spent. So we came to a compromise, and it was a fairly happy compromise. It was fine. But yeah, I mean, that was close. It would be all too easy for me to show up wearing, you know, really ridiculous clothes.
It might have made for a different experience for the evening.
It would have. Although I think Alison, the publicist at Jonathan Cape, who picked my wife and me up from the hotel before to take us to the event, she probably would have told me to go upstairs and change. So I think I might have been saved at the last minute by that. But yeah, that would have added quite a lot of stress as well. So yes, I'm glad that that turned out happily.
Given that it's been a few weeks since the win of the Booker Prize, what has that been like? And do you think this is going to change either you or your writing in general?
It's been very intense the last 2 or 3 weeks since then. I've done a lot of traveling, which was already in the diary, most of it actually. But of course, coming off the back of after the ceremony, I spent the rest of that week more or less in London and doing all kinds of stuff. So it's been pretty relentless. Good, of course. I'm very, very happy to be in this position. I'm halfway through a new book, and I'm very glad that I am, because it would be quite tough perhaps to start something from scratch at this point. And I really hope, I haven't been able to do any writing for a few months actually because of stuff around flesh, and but I hope that when I do get back to it, I'll be able to pick up more or less exactly where I left off and just carry on as if nothing had happened. But whether that actually is possible, time will tell.
As I understand, Roddy Doyle's advice to you after winning was to say no to everything, so I'm glad you didn't take it too seriously. It has been wonderful to talk to you tonight on Arena. David Soleil, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The Booker Prize winner for 2025, Flesh by David Soleil, is published by Jonathan Cape. That was Sparkle from Ruby Horse, the Cork band who departed for Boston in 1997 with a boom or bust dream, which ultimately saw them have a Billboard Top 20 mega hit, record with a Beatle, and basically live the rock and roll dream before it all slipped away. In his new memoir, All Roads Lead to Where You Are, Ruby Horse guitarist Joe Philpott charts the band's journey from Coloshta on Spirit Nave in Bishopstown all the way to Late Show with David Letterman and back again. And I'm delighted to be joined by Joe in studio now. Welcome to Arena, Joe.
Thanks for having me, Rick. Delighted to be here.
The story starts back in Coloshta and Spirit Nave in the late 80s. You had a guidance counsellor who told you to keep dreaming. That's not always necessarily the experience with Irish guidance counsellors. How does it feel to look back on that specific advice now, given where you ended up?
Well, you know, most advice you get when you're 16, you ignore. And duly, we did it. You know, we ignored it. So our school, Spirit Nave, was this magic box of an opportunity for us. Tony Doherty was actually an amazing teacher there who we had. But in that school, like, we had a stage, we had lights, we were given kind of free rein to run up into the corridors and kind of pull your bandmates out of class and go and rehearse. It was just an extraordinary kind of training ground for us to be able to kind of like form. And in the traditional way that you did back then, I mean, myself and the lads were actually in nursery school together. So we grew up on the same street. 4 or 5 years of age, went to secondary school, formed the band in Spirit Nave. and then had this mad ambition. And when you say, like, we were told to keep dreaming, he actually said, just don't drag anyone else down with you, is what he said. So, you know, it was amazing. It was an incredible experience to be given that opportunity.
The book paints this a really vivid picture of you in being teenagers, playing Sir Henry's in Cork and arriving in school uniforms and then changing into the band gear at the venue. I mean, talk to me about that stage, about what it was like playing at that stage when you were still so young.
When you're 14 or 15 and you sneak into your, you know, friend's older sister's band room, and there's just this, like, it's like, you know, welcome to Toy Town, Noddy. It's like every instrument you can imagine just hanging off the walls, and you plug in and you just get this electric shock, and you look at each other and you go, you know, we only could play a D chord between us. And it was just that unbelievable feeling of this loud and proud sound that was your passport to life now. And you walk out, you know, we wrote two songs or something in a day because we couldn't cover songs. So, like, we were literally able to kind of take that imagination that we had and bring it then into our school stage and play a concert, even though we didn't really know what we were doing. So, but I think what was extraordinary about us at the start, if there was anything extraordinary about us, was we kind of believed in what we were doing and we were dying to play shows. So something like Sir Henry's was like the kind of the beacon. It was the kind of light. It was like, if you played there, you made it. So our ambition at the time at 14 was to play Sir Henry's, and bands like Something Happens and A House and Hottest Flowers were all coming through. So we basically whippersnapped our way around the city begging for gigs at 15 years of age. Got one. Tony O'Donoghue, who's now a sports broadcaster or commentator for RT, was a local promoter, and we just annoyed him and bullied him into giving us the opening slots for these gigs, showing up off the number 8 bus in our school uniforms, and the bouncers at the door going, lads, where are you going? We're like, where are
we're the band.
We're the band. So it was amazing.
I'm going to skip forward a little bit. It boils down to this move you made in January of 1997, and you took this huge risk. You got a one-way ticket to Boston and you've got a grand in the bank. Why that route, and why risk it all?
We went there to fail. We kind of said, we kind of knew that we were in our early 20s and we were kind of kicking around and it was going to go nowhere really. And we kind of looked at each other and said, look, let's just go on this mad adventure. Should we be home in 3 months? You know, what have we got to lose? We literally had like $1,000 in cash, and, you know, we had a phone number of a uncle's friend's son who didn't know we were coming. He had just heard through the grapevine that there's a bunch of lads coming over. Are you okay to put them up for a couple of weeks? Yeah, no problem. We arrived. Snow all over Downtown Crossing. It was like coming into a movie. It was amazing. But we realized we needed to ring this guy from a payphone. So we rang him and we were like, Dave. And he's like, yeah, we're here. Who are you? And we were like, we're the Irish lads. We're over. Oh, yeah, okay. You know, and he's like, God, he came, picked us up in his tiny little car, drove us out to his apartment. And it was the Floor Seasons for about 3 weeks.
You started a residency at a place there called the Burren in Boston. Reading about it, it kind of sounds like it was something akin to the Beatles in Hamburg. It's got that, it made you tight and it made you sharp as musicians. What happened there?
Well, we were starving and we'd nowhere to live. And the thing we said when we left Ireland was that under no circumstances are we going to play in Irish bars. We wanted to experience the CBGBs. We wanted to kind of go out and experience America. But we were down to our last like breath. And we were standing in a tea stop and the Burren was there, and we just walked in and Tommy McCarthy and Louise had just opened up that bar, and it was sandwiched between Harvard University and Tufts University. And we walked in like drowned rats, like, and we just had nothing to eat, literally. And we were saying, can we have a gig? And he said, do you play acoustic? And we said, yes, even though we didn't. And he said, there's an acoustic session available in the back room on a Thursday night. And we took it. And within 5 weeks, there were like queues outside the door at 4 o'clock. The industry was coming from all over the world to see us. I actually don't know what happened. I don't know what the trigger was. I don't know what the switch was, because we couldn't get arrested here. We couldn't, nothing was happening for us, but literally within that short space of time. But I think when you take that leap, that fearless leap in any walk of life, and you just let go of the reins, sometimes mad things happen. And when your back's against the wall, and when you collectively start to fight for something, and, you know, we were making good music as well, clearly. I mean, people were coming to see us. So I just think there's an energy and an excitement. We were in our early 20s, and that period of your life, you get one opportunity to do something, you know, ridiculous like that. And I think we were brave, more foolish than brave, but that's where it all started for us.
So record labels start kind of sniffing around at this stage, you could have thoughts about a few of them, and you eventually signed with Interscope, and there's a legendary guy involved called Jimmy Iovine, who was Interscope at that stage. I understand the first meeting, though, didn't get off very well, did it?
No, we were kind of flown. Jimmy kind of intercepted in the way that Jimmy does. We were actually on the verge of signing with Sony, and the deal was kind of more or less agreed verbally by our manager at the time, Tim Collins, and we came home for Christmas and we weren't too gone on the idea. And then Jimmy rang the Burn, the old payphone, and the barman from Clare, West Clare, answered Desi, "Lads, there's a Jimmy Iovine on the phone for you." And we were like, okay. So Jimmy gets on the phone and he's like, you know, "Fly down to Los Angeles tomorrow. Let me have one chat with you before you sign the dotted line with Sony." Flew down, went out, had a few beers, and got into a bit of a fender bender on the way to meet Jimmy, and we were 45 minutes late for the meeting. So, like, you know, knowing Jimmy now, but in fairness, it was we had a little accident on the way. But yeah, he could have walked out. He could have been a very different man if he hadn't the patience.
How important were the Beatles in your musical formation? I'm asking that. I want to put in context getting George Harrison to play on one of your records. How does it come about that Harrison ends up playing slide guitar on Punch Drunk?
Like, even now thinking about it, I was talking to Declan there before I came in. It's just the thought of it is actually almost too big for my head. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, my parents had all the Beatles vinyl and I used to, you know, go in and listen to the Beatles. And I was fully aware of how culturally important they were. I mean, if you remember watching all those black and whites constantly being told. But now even they're the blueprint for everything, I think, in terms of pop music, in terms of a band, in terms of songwriting. So to think of myself as a 10-year-old listening to the Beatles records, and then realizing and actually, you know, putting into play an actual Beatle playing on the record. It was a very simple, you know, story around how it happened. I guess people have to read the book to find out how it happened. But
you can give us a broad overview.
Yeah, like it was our manager picked him up from Los Angeles LAX airport, and he put on the song. And George said, "Who's that?" And he said, "It's the Irish band I'm working with." He said, "I love that song." And Jeff said, "Would you play in it?" And he said, "Yeah." And he literally, Jeff came back to us and told us that this had happened, but there was no outcome, no kind of plan. And he said, and I said, "But Jeff, when he said, yeah, did he mean it?" And he said, "George doesn't say anything he doesn't mean." So nothing happened for months and we basically heard nothing. And he rang Jeff up one night and he said, "It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm in my kitchen drinking milk and I'm whistling that song. I have to record it. Send me the tapes and I think I've got a good idea." So we sent him the tapes from, we were in Miami, sent him over the tapes, and the rest then is how it unfolds. But the beautiful thing about it was his generosity of spirit. He charged us $25 union fee to make it official, and he gifted us his part.
Let's have a listen to that. And that is the 2020 version, as you've just pointed out to me, the one that was recorded during lockdown. And you're right, there's a great story about the whole rigmarole of how you have to end up going through the family. You had to go to the estate in order to get the rights for that.
Yeah, there was a kind of a bump on the road. It was just the whole way this beautiful serendipity that followed us around with George ended up during COVID. And that version of the song actually was a home recording we did. But to get permission to use the part, we didn't have permission because when it was originally recorded, there was nothing to cover digital release or online stuff, so we had to figure out how to do that. And there's a great story in the book about how that came about. Again, his spirit was following us around, I think.
Just before we finish, I want to ask you about REM, because you opened for them in Dublin.
Yeah.
But the story as to how you came to meet REM in the first place is great.
Yeah, we were in Georgia, Athens, Georgia, which is their hometown, and we were playing a show in the Georgia Theatre. And Dave just went out after soundcheck, our singer, just for a stroll around. It was a beautiful southern evening. And he bumped into the band walking on the street. And he was like, "Hey, lads." And they were like, "How are you?" And he said, "I'm Dave from Ruby Horse." And they were like, "Yeah. So we're playing tonight. If you want to come, I'll put you on the guest list." And they were like, "It's okay. We own the theatre." And they came. And we went out with them afterwards. And we had a great night, a long, thirsty night. And they said, "Look, when we're in Ireland next, you guys are opening up for us." And again, like, we kind of thought, sure, in true Ruby Horse fashion, we didn't get any contact details. And, you know, so eventually we tracked them down and we kind of sent them a little gift to the studio where they're recording. And literally MCD called us kind of when they were on the way back to Dublin saying, we got a call from REM's management. They want you guys to open up in Marley Park. So truth their word. And Peter Buck, I broke a string, or Decky broke a string on stage that day, and Peter Buck actually changed his string side of stage. So REM were our roadies is the hook.
The book is a fantastic read. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to me tonight.
I'm so glad to be here, and it's available in Waterstones and Hodges Figs and Leaf and Bower and Ballincollig.
I have a whole list. I have an entire list of where people can find it.
Brilliant. You're way ahead of me.
Joe Philpott, thanks for coming in.
Thanks
this evening. Congratulations on the book, All Roads Lead to Where You Are, From Bishopstown to the Beatles, by Joe Philpott, is out now. It is in Dubray Books in Waterstones in Cork, the Bandon Bookstore, Leaf and Bower in Ballincollig, and from Hodges Figgis in Dublin. There's nothing quite so festive as a rather grisly murder or two. And of course, I mean those contained within the pages of a good crime novel. From Scandi Noir to cosy crime to Hiberno Noir, maybe that should be Hiberno Dove, I don't know, the shelves of our local bookshops and libraries are straining under the weight of the new offerings from authors. But what are the best new crime novels this year that you could buy or borrow for yourself to read while the rest of the family sing carols or argue over that last afternoon tea biscuit? Declan Burke joins me now with his recommendations of the year's crime novels. Declan, you're very welcome. Why do you think people enjoy fictional crime so much at Christmas particularly?
At Christmas, maybe it's to do with the contrast. I mean, our perceptions or what we would want Christmas to be is that, you know, curling up beside the fire, log fire with a, you know, a good book and so forth. What I think crime fiction, mystery fiction delivers is the illusion that we can make sense of the world, Rick. I think that's what it is, that by the end of most crime or mystery novels, the killer has been unmasked, justice has been delivered and so forth. And I think that most crime readers, you know, we're not silly. We know that this is, you know, this is no substitute for reality. But it does provide a kind of an illusion that those kind of, that you know, good can triumph over evil and so forth. And that's why I think it's a lot of its appeal. And at this time of the year, that's always going to be a very important kind of sentiment.
I think there are two sets of readers of crime fiction as well. There are those who think that they can work their way through it and be one step ahead of whatever is happening. Or those like me who are completely helpless and are absolutely happy to just allow themselves be washed on by the wave.
I'm with you on that. I'm very happy to kind of let the author work their magic on me. My experience of dealing with other crime fiction authors is that if you're a reader who thinks that you're one step ahead of the author, that is probably because the author has dropped in the sufficient clues to help you do that. But yeah, I'm much more happy to sit back and let the prose and the characters bring me along. I'm not a reader that's that interested in plot, much more about characters and prose.
Okay, you brought along a fantastic selection of books to talk about. So first up is Murder at Gull's Nest by Jess Kidd. Features an Irish nun called Nora Breen. What's it all about?
Yeah, and it is a good example of character and prose because Jess Kidd is a terrific writer. She generally has kind of gothic motifs, not so much in this novel. So Nora Breen has left the convent. This is just after World War II in the UK. She's left her convent up north and she has travelled down to the seaside town of Gore-on-Sea to the Gull's Nest boarding house where a nun who was a friend of hers, Sister Frieda, has gone missing from that boarding house. So nobody seems to be taking her disappearance seriously. So Nora has left the convent, as I say, and has taken it upon herself to go to the boarding house as a civilian, quote unquote, and try to investigate what happened to Frieda. A great character, Nora Breen, describes herself early on as a middle-aged Joan of Arc, formidable but fun. I'm already on board with this woman. What she does very well, what Jess Kidd does very well, as a mystery reader yourself, Rick, you'll know that the outsider with the insider's eye and vice versa, that's, you know, it's a regular motif. Jess Kidd does that very well here. Nora Breen encounters an inspector Rideout who is, you know, he's the local inspector. He is very hard-nosed. He's a veteran of World War II. He's been scarred. he's a very practical man, whereas Nora Breen, being a nun or ex-nun as she is now, she is a listener. She's very intuitive. She has a more spiritual approach. And Rideout actually says to her at one point, you know, he says, "We want death like life to have a reason, every action pegged, every motive understood, every coincidence unpicked. Otherwise, what is there but chaos?" And in a nutshell, going back to your introduction, that sums up the appeal, I think, of crime fiction.
The older woman as a detective, it's a fairly well-worn trope from Miss Marple onwards. What does Jess Kidd bring to this that's new?
What Jess Kidd brings to this, and has always done over the course of her novels, she has a brilliant idea, a brilliant eye for the kind of character quirk and well, the quirks, they're not quirky per se, but distinctive characterizations and a lovely, sly sense of humour. And Nora Breen is very self-aware of both her strengths but also her limitations, that idea of being a middle-aged Joan of Arc. So that combination is very, very good. And the character of Nora is she's dogged. She is there, you know, not in the sense of a Miss Marple who is almost investigating the crime for the personal pride, almost for the thrill of discovery. She's there on a very personal mission. She wants to discover what happened to her beloved friend, and that gives it an added dimension as well.
Okay, we're going to move to Belfast now and to a novel where a young woman alleges that she's raped. It's a hard subject to tackle. It's called After the Party by Sharon Dempsey. What's this about?
Yeah, this starts off in a very unusual way, because we have a young woman called Georgia, who's a Belfast University student, and it's very clear in the first chapter she's stalking a fellow student, a guy called Hugh, and planning to destroy his life. And in terms of gender, that's an unusual twist, because usually it would be the male who's stalking the female character. And then Georgia lets us know that Hugh was one of three boys who was alleged to have raped Georgia the previous year at a university house party. Now, that's a fascinating and chilling setup in itself. But then what Sharon Dempsey does, and quite bravely, I think, is she switches perspective and brings us into the world of the mothers of the three boys who are accused. And that's Lydia, Colette and Helena. And these families are kind of from the well-heeled side of Belfast, if I can put it that way. The boys are rugby playing, they're, you know, morally upright and so forth, in theory at least. Certainly from a background of wealth, excuse me, and privilege. The women, of course, are utterly agreed that their sons are innocent. But as the story progresses, we realise that the families themselves are nowhere as perfect as the veneer that they present to the public really is. And also the women, one of the women in particular, starts to suspect that maybe her son is nowhere as innocent as she has believed. So the perspectives go back and forth from that of Georgia, who is being accused of making, wrong accusations, basically, and her life has been turned upside down, and that of the boys who are, ducking and diving from these allegations. So it's as you suggested when you were introducing the book, it's a very difficult subject matter. I completely commend Sharon Dempsey for taking on this kind of subject matter. But to me, as someone who's been reading crime fiction for the best part of 40 years at this point, this is what crime fiction does well. Crime fiction should be unsettling. It should be challenging. It should ask hard questions to which there are no easy answers. And that's exactly what Sharon Dempsey does. I mean, of all the books I've read this year, this is the one that stayed with me the longest.
It's quite the high wire act, isn't it, to tell the story in the way that it's told here in terms of structure. It could very easily go wrong.
Very, very much. And high wire is a perfect phrase to use for that, because what Sharon is doing is she's going back and forth from, you know, as I said, the allegations made against the boys, and our sympathies are with Georgia. We're naturally drawn to Georgia because we want to believe that these accusations he's making are true. And then we see the lives that are presented from the perspective of the three families. And in a sense that we want to believe that their world is as they portray it, because that is the ideal world that we all want to live in. And so to be able to convey convincingly both sides of that high wire act, can we present both sides of a high wire act? But to do that convincingly, it's a terrific achievement by Sharon Dempsey.
Okay, next up is the new novel by one of the biggest names in crime writing. That's Michael Connelly. It's called Nightshade. Where are we with this?
We are on Santa Catalina Island, off the coast of California, to be precise. So Michael Connelly, as you say, possibly the biggest name in crime and mystery fiction. Harry Bosch and Mickey Heller, I think there's 38 novels at this point between the two of them, plus quite a number of spin-off novels from those series too. This is very much a standalone, and it features an LAPD detective, Stillwell, who has been forced out of the homicide department in Los Angeles and basically sent into exile on Catalina, on one of the Catalina Islands. It's a backwater. It's a kind of a playground for the wealthy and the rich. The yachts moor up every Friday evening and the carousing begins and so forth. And it's a relatively easy station for Stillwell until there is a report comes in about a body that's found in the harbour, a young woman who has been weighed down by an anchor. Stillwell decides that this is his opportunity to prove to his superiors back in LA that he can still do the job. So he jumps feet first into the case.
He's well known for those series. I mean, Harry Bosch in particular, he is a new hero here. Does that give a kind of a new energy to the writing?
I felt it coming off the page, Rick. There's no doubt about that, because I love the Harry Bosch character in particular. But I would imagine with someone like Michael Connelly, who's writing these series novels, and the same applies to any other crime author, if you're writing a series, the chance to get a new character, you know, fresh clay and do what you want with that, you know, it has to be hugely relieving and freeing and creatively and so forth. Having said that, the character of Stillwell is someone that Harry Bosch would very much, approve of, I think, because at one point he says how he's conscious of, and I quote, the sacred bond between a victim and those charged with finding justice. And Harry Bosch himself has given a variation on that kind of line many times in the past. So I think if you're a fan of Harry Bosch novels, but you're looking for something slightly different from Michael Connelly, this would be the ideal book.
Okay. Next up, The Frozen People by Ellie Griffiths. She's known for her Ruth Galloway novels. Again, another new character here. It's about, I quote, a weird time-travelling mother. What's
yes,
going
indeed.
On here?
Well, that's the book in a nutshell, Rick. Again, hats off to Ellie Griffiths, because she could have continued to write the Ruth Galloway novels and people would have continued to read them because they're very, very good. What she has done with this series, it's the first in the series, The Frozen People, is that it's a cold case department that Ali Dawson works for. So far so traditional, but this is a cold case department that can go back in time to investigate very, very cold cases. So cases so cold, they're frozen, hence the frozen people. So Ali's boss has an assignment for her. He wants her to go back to 1850, back into the heart of the Victorian age, to investigate Cain Templeton, who is the great-great-grandfather of the Tory, current Tory MP, Isaac Templeton, and his forebear is being accused, possibly, of being a serial killer who preys on vulnerable women. Now, again, that's a very interesting setup. What Ellie Griffiths does is she kind of glosses over how they do the time travelling, which is a bit of a disappointment to me, because I like a bit of time travelling, Rick. But what's brilliant about this is that the character of Ali finds herself kind of marooned in 1850, and she's obliged to go undercover as a modern woman trying to go undercover in 1850. There's a lot of black humour involved in that, but she's also find herself coming under the aegis almost of Cain Templeton, the guy she's there, who is allegedly a serial killer and is taking a very sinister interest in her. It's very cleverly done. As I say, it's kind of blackly funny, very smart. The first in a series, and I hope this series is going to last for quite a while.
Okay, another Irish book up next. This time it's set in Derry. It's The One You Least Suspect by Brian McGilloway. What's this one about?
This is about a barmaid called Katie Hamill, and she works as a bartlinger in Derry, and she works for the O'Reilly brothers, they own a series of bars, but they're also major players in Derry's illegal drug trade. So Katie one night is approached by the special branch, and basically she's put in a headlock and told, we need you to inform on the O'Reillys. Now Katie is not stupid, she lived in Derry all her life, and as she tells us, the history of Derry was littered with the dead bodies of those who had been accused of informing to the police or special branch against paramilitary. So this is a rock and a hard place, and particularly because Katie has a young daughter called Hope. She's a single mum, and Hope is utterly dependent on Katie. She's very, very hard decisions to make. What was brilliant, I mean, I think Brian McGillivray is one of the very best of the Irish crime writers. He's absolutely terrific, lovely writer on a line-by-line basis. What he does terrifically and has done really well here is he has presented a heroine who is by no means typical. Her plight isn't tragic. It's not grand. There's going to be no helicopter chases. There's going to be no, you know, coups. This is a young woman who finds herself in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the reason why the book works so well and worked so well for me is wonderfully tense and chilling, because you understand that just finding yourself in the wrong place at the wrong time, you could end up getting chewed up by the machinery of life in the way that Katie Hamill does. Kafkaesque in a crime novel, it's a lovely combination.
It's a very different setting for the next one you've chosen. Blarney Castle. Some of This Is True by Michelle McDonough. Tell me what this one is about.
So, again, with wearying inevitability, Rick, a young woman is found dead in the first chapter. That young woman is the American tourist Jessie DeMarco, who is found dead at the bottom of the wishing steps at Blarney Castle. Looks like a tragic accident. She has slipped on ice, perhaps. Her bereft mother, Danny, arrives from America to identify the daughter's body. What she brings with her is information about the name of the father that Jessie had arrived in Ireland looking for. And that sets the cat among the pigeons in the Blarney community. Now, we have what Michelle McDonough does really well here, I think, is she's writing a domestic noir, and domestic noir kind of thrives on one profound question, and that's how well really can you trust the people that you need to trust the most. So we have a very small and tightly knit community. Danny is staying with Maria Murphy, who runs a B&B. Maria is friendly with the woman who's accused of being, who is married to the man who is accused of being Jesse's father. It's all a wee bit complicated, brilliantly plotted, complicated the way I'm explaining it. But what Michelle does really, really well, I think, is that the way she gets her characters, her female characters in the community, to start asking one another questions about their husbands, their sons, their brothers, and how well do we really know how these men would behave in any given situation. Beautifully told, brilliant setting, Blarney and the castle and so forth. But what really hit me home about this for me was this idea about the suspicion that we are automatically asked once a young woman has been killed in her midst, how well can we trust the men that she knew?
John le Carré's son is next. It's Nick Harkaway, who's an author, very much so in his own right these days. It's called Sleeper Beach. He published a follow-up to one of the Smiley books last year, but this is obviously not in the spy vein at all.
No, so he introduces a character called Cal Sounder, and Cal Sounder is a titan. He has been taking a rare drug called T7, which renders him almost superhuman. He's also a private detective. So when a young woman washes up dead on a beach, Rick, with wearying inevitability yet again. So Martha Erskine, who's the matriarch of the town, she commissions Cal Sounder to come and investigate. What really struck me about this is that, in a sense, it's speculative fiction because we're dealing with this idea of Cal Sounder being a titan and a kind of a superhuman private eye. The secular divine is how he's described, and that's the future of investigation and policing, as suggested by Nick Harkaway. But the book also looks back to the classic kind of pulp detectives, and particularly the Continental Lop that was popularised by Dashiell Hammett, who often found himself fighting on behalf of the marginalised and the disenfranchised and so forth. And this story revolves around the dead woman we discover was a kind of a Marxist revolutionary. He was trying to organise strikes and so forth. Is that the reason why she was killed? We don't know. But the book is, as I say, that lovely blend between speculative fiction and a real throwback to classic crime fiction. And the blend works very, very well.
I want to make sure we get a mention in for Mick Herron's Clown Town, because it's the infinitely readable Mick Herron, who just seems to continue to bring out Slow Horses books one after the other, and without any seeming lack in quality.
Yeah, look, at this stage, the formula, if I can call it a formula, is very well established. Intricate plot, simmering tension, an intelligence service that hums with mundanity and mendacity, and the X-rated dialogue, of course, which we all love, courtesy of Jackson Lamb. He just, you know, character assassinations on every second page. So in this book, we have undercover group that worked for MI5 during the Troubles and who were protecting effectively a source who was a psychopathic killer. And they are now trying to blackmail MI5. And Diana Taverner, who is the first desk at MI5, she doesn't respond well to threats. So she sees an opportunity to send Jackson Lamb's slow horses into the Minster to look after this threat. And of course, Jackson Lamb does not like it when people start messing with his jaws, because he's the only one who was allowed to mess with his jaws. Yeah, John le Carré, you mentioned, he used a spy novel to chart the decline of Britain's influence on the global stage. And Mick Hearn does exactly the same, but with a quality of comic absurdity that makes them, as you say, deliciously readable.
Yeah, for those people who've only maybe seen the TV series on Apple and who maybe wonder whether or not they can jump into this at any point, is it a series you can just come into at any stage?
Yeah, I think like most series, it would benefit if you start at the start, but each book effectively works as a standalone, so there's no stopping you starting with Clown Town and going back to the first or anything like that. Yeah, they work as standalones. And yeah, and one thing about the TV series, you know, you've read the books and so forth, they have cleaved really closely to the source material.
Very much so, yeah. He uses the slow horses and the slow house books to kind of do a lot of sly commentary on modern Britain as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, so usually, as we know with the spy novels, the threat is invariably from without. You know, it'll be Russia, it'll be whatever it happens to be. Here, the threat is almost always from within. And it's a manifestation of some way that Britain has managed to go wrong. And over the last three or four books, for example, it's been hilarious. The kind of self-serving politicians with the background of Brexit and so forth, he's brilliant at that. And it's, you know, it is satire. It stands up as proper satire within the framework of a spy novel.
Declan Burke, thanks a million for coming in to talk to us tonight. The books mentioned include Murder at Gull's Nest by Jess Kidd, After the Party by Sharon Dempsey, Nightshade by Michael Connolly, Ellie Griffith's The Frozen People, Brian McGilloway's The One You Least Suspect, Some of This Is True by Michelle McDonough, Sleeper Beach by Nick Harkaway, and Clown Town by Mick Herron. And that is it for tonight's Arena. Sheila O'Callaghan was our producer tonight, researched by Paula Shields. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator, and it was Patter Carney on sound. I'll talk to you at 7 o'clock tomorrow night here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon is up after the news.